Yes, my name is Dan Fish, and this session is titled Nicaragua, a Project in a War Zone. Before I get started with the project and information there, I think it's important to go over a brief history of Nicaragua and what's happened in the recent years. I'll be referring to some of the... this background information will be important in things that I refer to. I'd like to start out with going over a map. We have a few copies here, if you could share, pass those around. Very few copies. I'll also do a general sketch up here on the... this is more or less Nicaragua. Going off into Honduras and Costa Rica down here. Most of the population of Nicaragua is on the west coast. 10% of the population lives on the east coast. It's mostly jungle and mountainous territory where there's native Indians and then a Negro population that was populated by the British, and they speak English. But most of the events happen, are concerned in the eastern part. Managua, the capital has one third of the population in the capital. There's 3 million, a population of 3 million. The west coast is where the fertile soil is. That's where most of the cities are, you can see on your map. We have a lot of volcanoes along that area, and that has provided good fertilization for the soil. The U.S. interests in Nicaragua came at the end of the 19th century when they were looking for a place to for a canal zone, and they thought they could use Lake Nicaragua and connect the lake from both sides. There's a river from the Atlantic coast that goes to the lake, and they could just canal from the lake to the Pacific Ocean. That didn't pan out, but the business interest started with that attention and that interest in the canal. And early in the 20th century, 1912 to 1930, the U.S. Marines invaded three times to help control the peasants. During this time, Augusto Sandino organized a small rebellion of somewhere from 100 to 200 soldiers, and he helped attack the Marines and finally forced them to leave in 1933. They were there right, they knew that the rebels were getting tired of them being there, and before they left, they trained a National Guard and left Somoza, I forgot which Somoza that was, in charge of the National Guard. And one of the first acts Somoza did was to invite Sandino to a peace dinner to reconcile the both sides. And he assassinated Sandino at that dinner. That started the brutal repression of the Somoza regime dynasty that lasted for 45 years and three different Somoza leaders. Right before Somoza was overthrown in 1979, he had gathered so much wealth. He had owned 40% of the business in Nicaragua, the 26 largest companies, and he had one-fifth of the fertile land in his hands. On the other hand, there was a great amount of poverty in Nicaragua, 50% illiteracy, infant mortality at 200 per 1,000, where in the U.S. it's somewhere between 13 and 14 for 1,000. The water systems were a great cause of the deaths and disease. There was very little water services for the poor in the countryside. The Sandinistas started in the late 60s, and there was some youth that saw this oppression and this inequality and started to wonder what they could do about it. At the same time, there was a changing in the Catholic Church, where they opted for the poor in the Medellin conference. And so at both times there was parallel advancements in both the universities and the Catholic Church, trying to pay more attention to the poor and trying to help the conditions in Nicaragua. In the Catholic Church, they started having small groups meeting to see how they could respond to the oppression that was going on. And slowly through the 70s, more and more people decided that their faith response was to join armed resistance to the brutality that was going on. Towards the mid-70s, the Sandinista developed an army of approximately 6,000 that was fighting against the National Guard that had between 15 and 20,000. A couple things that during the 70s that really changed the environment of the war was an earthquake that happened in 1972 that destroyed Managua, the capital. It left 15,000 dead and 100,000 homeless. And a lot of aid came flooding into the country. And Somoza pocketed most of this aid. He took food that was donated for the poor and sold it to the poor and pocketed the money. This was widely reported, and it changed the attitude of the middle class and the business class towards Somoza. He started to lose his support in Nicaragua. And in the final days of 1979, he just turned against all the people and started bombing his own towns and cities. People started gathering in churches, and I saw a church in Esteli that had been bombed, that people had gone into for refuge. And there was a church in León where military people just went in and started killing the people. This was a flavor of his oppression that had been going on for so long. In the last two or three years of the revolution, 40,000 people died, and the majority of those people were civilians. So one out of every 75 persons died, so almost everyone knew someone that had died in the revolution. After the revolution, there was a state of euphoria. And the work then began to start a new Nicaragua. They started a literacy campaign that organized volunteers from schools, from high schools and colleges. They would go on 3 months campaign, and the people that had been in the city studying went out to the countryside and started training people how to read and write. And it was a very effective way to galvanize the Nicaragua, because people that had been living in the city would be able to see what the conditions were out in the countryside and see what the fighting was all about and the hope for the future and be able to participate in education. There was an extensive health care program to improve the health systems, water systems, and decrease the infant mortality, there was immunization programs. All the medical students had to spend a year out in the countryside as part of their studies for their 5-year programs for becoming doctors. And they organized immunization programs. And these programs are still going on. That's a basic history, a brief overview of Nicaragua. In 1984, I went with a group called Witness for Peace that had a ecumenical-based, nonviolent approach towards Nicaragua and exposing people to Nicaragua. They had the belief that the Contras knew through information through the CIA where Americans were and would not attack areas where the U.S. citizens were. And so by placing U.S. citizens in the war zone, they were protecting, if for a short period of time, they were protecting the people in those towns and also showing U.S. citizens what was happening, what the Contras were up to. I went down in 84 for 8 days and was very affected to see what tax dollars were what was happening with the tax dollars in Nicaragua. And we went up to Jalapa, which is further along above Ocotá, which is real close to Honduras. The Contras are mainly in the middle section of Nicaragua. This main population is here, and then you have a mountain ridge right along the middle here, and that's where there's less development. The development's less out in this area, and the Contras can form corridors where they can get supply lines to the middle of the country. Most of the activity is on the borders, but they've been, in the last 4 or 5 years, they've been controlling the whole middle area down here. And they would come in through Jalapa and Ocotá. I lived with a family there for just 2 days and was able to see tension in the war zone. Even though life continues regularly, there's always a question of when the next attack's going to be. And when you hear shots off in the countryside, the militia gets together and goes to the local military post to get armed and start patrolling the streets and outside the cities. And it's the wives just don't know if their husbands are going to return. They hear shots going off, and that's what hit me. The war zones, that the U.S. sends money throughout the world, but then to see the terror that this creates really affects me to see what the money was up to. And I'd always heard about terrorism, but then to actually see the terror that it creates is very effective. I went back to the U.S. With a new direction in my life and started to work in peace and solidarity groups in Chicago. After a couple of years, that work became tedious and hard to see the results, and we always like to see the results of our work. And so when this project came up that I started on, I was at that point where I needed to help out directly. It was a group of carpenters that came to our church. One was connected with our church, and he asked us to help out with a Tools for Peace campaign and try to have people donate old tools that they had in their basement and other ways that we could help out with the project. I started helping out immediately. This project is called IPAL, El Proyecto Apoyo Laboral, or the Labor Support Project. And it's basically the idea of two carpenters, union carpenters that had supported the union, organizing donations, large wood processing equipment, and buying trucks and driving these equipment down. This started in 86 and went to an area right in the middle of Nicaragua. If you do a bullseye in Nicaragua and throw a dart at it, that's where this machine ended up. There were two cooperatives that we started, and one cooperative is at the end of the line. You can't drive any further. That's where the road stops. You have to get on muleback to go any further. When I first went there, it was extremely hard to get there. The war was going on strong in 87 when I first went with this project, and Ben Linder had just been killed by the Contras, and so the Sandinistas were evacuating a lot of the internationals out of the war zone, trying to protect themselves and keep people safe. There is a Catholic project that helps agricultural cooperatives called the Cristo Rey Project, or Christ the King Project, and they have helped the flow of materials and housing construction in this area. This is an area where there was a lot of Contra activity, and it also is an area where there's a lot of displaced people. If you're living out in a farm out in the war zone, it's very hard to survive if you don't give aid to the Contras. They're going to harass you until you give aid, and if you don't give them food or support, they're going to make your life so difficult that you're going to have to leave. Our cooperative is made up of this one cooperative in Bocana de Paiwas. Is made up of 10 women. Half of them are widows because of the war, and they were continued to live out in the countryside when they were widows, but then the Contras came again and attacked their houses. There was one woman not connected with the cooperative, but was living out there alone, running her farm with her 5 children, and some of them quite small. And the Contras came and set her house on fire. And she went running from her house, and then the Contras opened fire. And her son, that was about 7, showed me a big scar on his leg. And that's how the Contras terrorized the people. There's a lot of displaced people in this area, therefore, and there's a great housing shortage. A lot of people come to Bocana de Paiwas looking for housing or place to stay, and then these people get together, form a farming cooperative that's close to the road, close to Paiwas, maybe only 5 kilometers away, and so they can go back to Paiwas for protection, or they live with maybe 20 families, 15 families together. So there's enough people to have an armed guard, support a guard for their community. But these are often targets for the Contras, even though they're trying to get away. It's a lot better than the situation where they were, where there could be 5 kilometers before there's another house living all alone. They've come and formed cooperatives where they can protect themselves, share transportation and work together on the land. Our project is to help provide a source of housing. This is also a place where there's a lot of wood, raw material, that normally goes for a 6-hour drive to Matagalpa, where it can get processed and then comes back where they can use it to build their houses. We sent down joiners, planers, swing saws, so they can process the wood right there that comes from the mill. In the last 3 years, I've been down 3 times for 2 months each time. I've helped out by constructing concrete bases for the machinery, helping out by installing light and electricity in the shops, and this last time I helped build a second floor in the small shop that's in Paiwas. We also have a shop in Rio Blanco, which is the last trading post before you get to the end of the line. Paiwas, which is the end of the line, is an hour away from Rio Blanco. The first time in 87 when I was there, there was very little transportation. The war was still going on very strong. My first night there, there was a battle right outside town, and I remember the ambulances going back and forth. The roads are often closed and transportation is very difficult. There was only approximately three rides to Paiwas a week when I was there in 87. This last time, things are quite more open. The war has slowed down. I would say there was 3 or 4 rides to Paiwas each day. So things are opening up. There's less fear of being attacked on the road. Occasionally there are attacks, even now, but there's a sense that things are slowing down. There was a woman from Paiwas whose husband had been killed in the war, and she was a delegate of the Word working with the Catholic Church, and she helped start a daycare center in Paiwas so the women could start working in cooperatives. The church started a baking cooperative and a sewing cooperative, and we've been helping to start a carpentry cooperative. And she helped by starting the daycare center. And she was starting a store to provide low-priced basic foods for people out in the countryside. They come in on horseback to Paiwas because that's the last town on the road where you can get basic food and basic supplies for your farm. This is a government-supported project. They supply the supplies at a subsidized rate. And anyone that starts to take part in government supported projects is taking their lives at hand. And in December of 1987, there was an ambush on the road to Paiwas, and she was killed by a landmine. She was a very strong woman, and it was a very great loss to the community. But there's so much hope in the community that you know there's always someone that's going to come and replace her. Her death gives strength to more and more people. That's one incredible thing about Nicaragua. There's so much adversity there and troubled times, but there's so much hope there also for the future. let me give you an overview of the lifestyle in Nicaragua, where I was staying in Rio Blanco. Most people have dirt floors and just a wooden frame of a house. The kitchen's out back, but usually under the same roof, so the smoke comes up the roof and then down into the house. Every person usually has one spigot on their property. It's usually out back, away from the house. And water will come for a couple hours each day, if they're lucky. It can be a week before water comes again. And so they fill up a barrel and all the 5-gallon jugs that they've managed to accumulate. This place that I stayed didn't have electricity, even though the town did. And at night, I remember going to sleep with a little diesel candle off on the corner of the room. When we took down the machines in 87, in 88, it became apparent that we needed to supply our own electricity for the shop. The electricity had been out for 2 months, a month when we got there, and it was out for the 2 months that I was there. The Contras had attacked a generator about a mile up the road, and all the communities along the road were without electricity for 3 or 4 months. What I have seen throughout my visits there is a U.S. policy that is slowly melting away the energies of the Nicaraguan people. It's taxes them in form of inflation, where the Sandinistas continually supplying money to defend themselves and to defend their projects. The inflation and the economy has been hard hit. In the 2 months that I was there this time, the Cordoba rose from 6,300 to 9,500 in 2 months. That puts a very difficult burden on trying to start cooperatives or trying to get an economic stability in any kind of business. The Contras policy has been to attack the developmental programs of the Sandinistas. They've attacked land reform trucks that have helped start these cooperatives, land cooperatives, in the countryside. They help supply fertilizer, seeds, and other needs of these communities. They also have attacked healthcare workers in the countryside. The Sandinistas would like to have a very extensive healthcare system free for anyone, but it's very difficult when people are afraid to participate in it because they've seen other people die who have participated in it. The vaccines are available in Rio Blanco for communities, for outlying communities, but it's the responsibility for the outlying communities to elect a person to come in and pick up the vaccinations and take it out to that community. But they're frightened to do that because of the fear of being attacked by the Contras. The church is trying to make it a faith act part of a Christian act to go and be able to help the children of your community and go and pick up some much needed medicines in the local town. The Sandinistas have been very successful in education. They've continued their process of literacy and have built over 2,000 schools in communities that have never had schools before. Recently, this last time, I was surprised at the measures that have, the changes that I had seen. The first two times I was there in 87 and 88, the war was going on strong, and it was, those two times were very similar, and I was expecting a similar situation this time. But through the Arias peace plan and recent efforts to slow down the war, the change is evident there. There have been concessions by the Sandinistas, and the Contras have slowed down their attacks. This is a signal that the people in Nicaragua are tired of war and are tired of killing each other. The Sandinistas have opened up the economy, and people can't afford them. I'm afraid that there's going to be more hunger in the near future in Nicaragua because fewer and fewer things are being subsidized. The Nicaraguan government is just opening up the economy. They're going away from the policy of controlled production, controlled distribution. They've recently released 2,000 ex-National Guardsmen that were placed in jail after the revolution. They've been there for 10 years now. And this was met by mixed response by the population. A lot of people have vivid memories of close family members or close friends that had been brutally tortured and murdered by the ex-National Guard. These are the prisoners that were exemplary, that took part in all the Sandinista programs of education and work programs that were available for them, and trained in new vocations. A lot of people think that these people were just doing the smartest thing available, taking part in what was available for them and realizing that they would be getting out sooner by taking these policies. Other people, there were quite a few people that realized that reconciliation needs to take place and some healing needs to happen for Nicaragua to continue and go forward. And even though I talked to a young woman that was in the Sandinista army, and her father was killed in 1978 in the revolution, but she was understanding and glad that this reconciliation process is beginning to happen. She doesn't want to see the war continue. The Sandinista also laid off, the government also laid off 60,000 people out of a country of 3 million. That's quite a large percentage of people that found themselves without a job that had been working with the government. This was a government that was very bureaucratized, and they realized that they could not continue spending money the way they had and supplying these kinds of jobs. And so there's effort for people to work harder, and they streamline the government system. Although sometimes it still doesn't seem like it's streamlined when you're trying to get tires for your truck. And the roads out there are incredible. Your tires will last about 3 months. Our project is estimated to take 5 years. It's been 3 years now. And just this last December, the generator was delivered and our machine started working. And the men's cooperative started to be able to produce the wood. But wood now is so expensive to buy that it's hard for them to get many projects going. By the time they set on a price, an agreement, they go out and buy the wood, it's just not economically feasible for them to make it and then sell it and have enough money to buy more wood to continue for another project. The inflation just is rampant there. So we're hoping for the economy to settle down for a lot of projects are finding it very difficult to continue. There was a baking cooperative in Piwas that I mentioned. They're out of business right now because they can't afford flour to bake bread. It's not that it's so, it has gone up, but they have to buy it from Managua. But transportation costs are so incredible in Nicaragua. It just for the diesel fuel for a truck from Managua to Piwas cost $80. It's a full day's trip. The price of diesel has more than quadrupled as the government ceased to subsidize petroleum. I think I'd like to now open up time for discussion and questions to see what if there's information or questions that you have.
Are the American funds cut off somewhat now for Contras? Just supposedly some economic aid, no military aid?
Yeah, that's there's now just humanitarian aid going to the Contras to continue their support while this peace process is going on. But from priests that go out into the countryside and into the war side on little tours to go to little chapels in communities, reports back from them have been that the Contras are more equipped now than they have ever been. Through this rest period, they've been able to funnel all their equipment and their arms into a ready position, and they're continuing to be a very frightening threat. And there are stories of Sandinista military officials returning home for a weekend and being dragged out of their houses and shot. So their military presence is still there.
I noticed Ali North to be sentenced tomorrow.
Is that true?
I heard that the Contras would be going and making raids and stuff sort of disguised as Sandinistas or trying to make it look like it had been Sandinista and vice versa, and I was wondering if you've seen any of that.
It's hard to tell who's who out in the war zone because they wear the same camouflage military uniforms. And when the Sandinistas capture the Contras, the Sandinistas don't have many materials, so they use all the materials that they've captured. And so everything becomes confused. I was told that one way is to tell by the boots and also by some of the armament. You can tell who's who. But there was always accusations that it's the other side that did it to make the one side look bad. It's the Sandinistas that mine the road to make the Contras look bad. And in the war zone, it's really hard. It's confusing to be able to sort things out.
Yes. I'm not well informed. Do the Sandinistas belong to the government, or do you?
Okay, yeah, the Sandinistas, FSLN is the Sandinista Liberation Front. It's a political party that has a majority of the governmental power, and it's the name of the government army.
All right, does the government belong to the wealthy, or who controls it?
The government was put in place after the revolution, which threw out the ex-National Guard that served to keep Somoza in power and his wealth, keep the wealth in small hands. Since the revolution, there's been an effort to distribute the wealth, and the Sandinistas have been trying to fight off the counter-revolutionaries, which are mostly ex-National Guards that are trying to get back some of the power that they have lost.
They are not the poor people who want something. They're actually the ones who did have the power. They were the oppressors then.
Right, the people that we support now with humanitarian aid.
We're supporting them.
Yes, we have been for the last since 1982.
And you're fighting the Sandinistas, right? Yeah. But who's the leader now? What's the name?
Daniel Ortega is the leader of the Sandinistas. Somoza. Unfortunately, the Contras don't usually attack the Sandinista troops. They normally attack people that are taking part in government projects to help the poor.
Do you see evidence of Russia in Nicaragua in your travels?
Yes, I have. I've seen a lot of tractors and a lot of trucks and a lot of cars. Those are the things that are visible. The AK-47s are from Russia, I suppose. It's hard to tell how much military support they have from Russia or where their military support comes from. I'm sure they have figures on that. I haven't looked into that. The boycott. One thing I haven't mentioned is the boycott has severely hurt Nicaragua. Their system, their whole business system was set up through America and the U.S. And to have that boycott come and cut off all the spare parts for businesses, for cars, for tractors, for agriculture, a lot of things just, once they broke down, came to a halt. It's been very hard to get repair things there and get parts for anything. They've received a lot of donations from Eastern Bloc and even Western Europe for different areas, but it's hard to transfer your system from one economic area to another.
When I was in Nicaragua in November of 1988, we spoke with the Swedish embassy, and it seems to me that there's a lot of aid coming in from Sweden, and that the Sandinista government is trying to remodel its economy and its political system to something similar to that of the Scandinavian countries. Mm-hmm. And it seems that it has been forced to receive aid from the Soviet Union because it was unable to get enough from other countries, namely the United States.
They would be more than happy to do business with the U.S., but it's impossible at the moment. I met a person from Sweden that was a part of a government program. He got a stipend from his government, and his government sent him to work down in Nicaragua for 2 years. Sweden has good programs like this, and they, when I was down there, it was reported in the newspaper that Sweden is continuing its aid to a larger extent to Nicaragua, and there are more countries now that are continuing aid to Nicaragua now that the peace process is opening up. There was a time there in 86 and 87 where there was some international pressure and aid from foreign countries was slowing down. It seems to be turning to a better road now, and there seems to be a lot of hope now for the future.
Do you think, though, that the Sandinista government is... I was there in 83, and I think the Sandinistas have changed and maybe been forced to change by the policies that the United States has had, but as they've moved further left and become a bit more frightening, they're very frightening to ex-President Reagan when he came in power, and that's, I think, why he pulled back so much, and Carter was more diplomatic, what you would say, to the Sandinistas, and now, but don't you think the Sandinistas have changed too? Are they more frightening to us now than they were in 83? Do you see the left side being more open and upfront? And I mean, we have to talk about Marxism as part of the whole system because that's very evident.
Yep.
I'm not against Marxism. I think Nicaragua should have their choice to become the country they want to, and I think the Contras have done unbelievable harm in that country. But I've sensed the Sandinistas have changed their position too.
I wasn't aware about Nicaragua in 83, but I'm not sure their policies earlier on. It's just been in the last 2 years that I've really gotten a feel for how things are going. I'm not totally for the Sandinistas. Some of their things are quite frightening. There was a policy where they could, at one point when they were promoting a controlled production and distribution, there was a point where they could go into a home and search it to see if someone was hoarding materials. And if they were, they could take them out of the house. And that frightened quite a few people. I think that the coming up elections and the hope for peace has made the Nicaraguans and the Sandinistas think about what's more practical instead of what's more ideological. I think there was a time when the Sandinistas were real ideological. And through their experiences of learning how to run a country, they're learning. I believe they are changing. And I don't know how much to attribute that to the Contras and that pressure. I think that has caused them to do things a lot differently because they've had to put so much resources into the military when they have wanted to put resources into healthcare and education.
Personal question. How did you begin to feel drawn to serve like this in Nicaragua, and what happened to you in the process of working there? Could you tell us about some of the changes in thinking, or perhaps even in your perspective of the world? Did that change as you started to work there?
Well, I hadn't had much of a political perspective before I went to Nicaragua. I wasn't much interested. in Nicaragua. Just seeing, I was realizing that the U.S. had never had a war in its own territory, and yet the U.S. is exporting war all over the world. And I was very affected when I, my first time when I saw the injustice that was going on in Nicaragua. And I just couldn't sit still after seeing what was going on. I needed to do something about it. And that's where I started getting involved. It's not just me wanting to go and help these people. It's also, they're wonderful people. The Latin American culture that I've gotten to know in Nicaragua is wonderful, the way they just open up their hearts and their lives to you. And you live with them and they share everything. They're very humble people, but they'll share everything they have. That was something new to me. And it's also exciting working down there because there's so much excitement about the future. The people believe that they do make a difference and that the future is in their hands and that they can make a difference and be a part of what the future is. And after being in the U.S. where there's isn't that hope for the future and there's such an emphasis on the individual, I just felt I fit in more in that kind of environment. And each time I go down, it's harder and harder to tear myself away and come back here.
Now, who funds this project that you go down with?
There's a group that fluctuates. There's a group of about 15 to 20 people in Chicago that raise funds however we can. And some, one's a nurse, and so she raises funds, she does a few projects, and then tries to find where she can buy wholesale medicines. And one is a labor organizer, and he tries to get his labor union to help donate and find other sources of labor funds. And our church has done some fundraisers, and we've done a tool for peace campaign. This group of 15 just helps out in different ways to raise the funds.
Pretty small group still, really.
Yes, the mailing list, that's the core group. We meet, we try to meet every Friday night in the shop in a Hispanic neighborhood in Chicago where the director of the project lives. And we're either crating up donations, cleaning up donations, having a slideshow, or planning a new fundraiser. So we have a mailing list of over 200 people that we have a newsletter that goes out to. And so our funds are coming in from a lot of different parts of the U.S.
When you go down to Nicaragua, then do you run into other people that are doing the same thing that you're doing?
Yes. As a matter of fact, there's people down in Paiwas working with the women right now that were working in another part of Nicaragua, and their project there had finished up. And they were looking for something else to do. Two people from Hawaii, cabinet makers. And they heard about our project and are now working with us off and on for the next year, which is very good because we needed someone down there to oversee the project, a continual. With the women, we need to train them how to work the machines and how to do carpentry, they aren't carpenters. And so it's a much bigger training project. With the men in Rio Blanco, it was a group of men that were carpenters, and they were excited to get these power machines. And now we have to train them how to work cooperatively. At the moment, they're bringing their projects. They're all looking for individual projects, and it's building one wardrobe or one desk or one chair. And these machines are capable of producing 200 doors, 200 windows. And we need to develop. In the next year or two, our project is developing our clientele base, where we find large-term contracts and forms of transportation.
You haven't any problem with the government then, for these projects?
The U.S. government or the Sandinistas?
The Nicaraguan government.
They have been helpful. The Board of Education in Rio Blanco donated the building for us to use as a shop. They had an extra building that had been built in 82 by, I think it was some Germans who came down and wanted to start a carpentry shop. And they built this shop and left. And the project never continued past that. So they were using it as a school. And then they donated to us. And in Piwas, we also had a building that was donated that was to be a house for a rich landowner that was just been given a large quantity of land before the revolution. Started building a house, and the revolution came right in the middle of his construction project, and he left it. So we were donated that building also. And this summer I went there and finished the second building it by putting in a second floor. Yes.
Why does our government seem to be so afraid of the Nicaraguan government?
I think it's, my opinion is that the Nicaraguan government is a good example of breaking away from U.S.-controlled dictatorship and forming your own self-determined government, a combination of Marxism, Christianity. It has a mixed economy, and it seemed to be working real well in the first couple of years. And I think the U.S. was afraid that it was going to give more power to the revolution in El Salvador, and more power, and El Salvador in turn would start stirring things up in Guatemala. Things are a little uneasy in Guatemala right now. And it would just take a little spark for things to start going there. I think they were afraid of the example that Nicaragua would set.
Aren't there several priests in the Nicaraguan government, the Conjunto?
There are. Cardinal is the Minister of Culture. I believe. Don't quote me on that.
Do the Sandinistas have the support of the American public from anything that you've heard or polls or anything?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure a lot of the American public know who the Sandinistas are. But I've heard from polls that the public is in support of letting self-determination take place in Nicaragua. That the U.S. should let Nicaragua continue on its own.
Yeah. What is there anything that the Contras are doing now that is positive or good? And if not,
And why in the world are we, or were we supporting them?
Yeah, feel free to get up and leave. We'll continue this for a few minutes. Our government didn't like the Sandinistas and the policies that they were making, and were afraid that if they let the Sandinistas go free, that they would just go off to the right, off to the left so far, become Marxist and become a center of Soviet support down in our backyard. I think that the Nicaraguans have turned to the Soviet because they've had no one else to turn to. I think that the U.S. could have completely changed things and have supported Nicaragua, and by being friends, we could have influenced them to remain mixed and not go off so far to the left as they've had to. I don't know why we've supported... Why did we train, send in the Marines in the early 1920s and train oppressors back then? It's what the U.S. does. Yes?
One of the persons working here on campus, lonely Evokakun, I went through it quite rapidly. Paul Meyer Nelson, he's a Lutheran pastor, spent 2 years there and has just taken a job as book editor for the Lutheran. I mean, book editor for Augsburg Fortress. He's the one that asked my wife to write the book. Ordinary Christians. But he has a terrifying story about the fact that he quotes from all the prestigious people in our government the last 6 years.
It's scary.
The U.S. wants us to continue 50% containment of all the properties in the world, which we have. We use 50% of all the gross goods at a 6.5% population. And it's quite clear from statements from the gal that used to be in the UN, from the Secretary of State, from the Secretary of the Military, that they say this without any question across the last 8 years. And we want what we have. And they say we have to suppress. And the book really says it's low-intensity conflict. And you keep the poor poor, because if you do, they won't rise to disturb you or our corporate structure. Statements like 10 corporations own almost all of the communication in America. The three networks, the HBO, the Time, Newsweek, publications, 330 cables and stuff.